The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk
on 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show brought to you by Absa CIB. It's host of world-class events such as the Absa Champagne in Africa Festival, which we were lucky enough to broadcast from on Wednesday. We saw many of you there and you were having a very nice time. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP. Welcome to tonight's Friday evening edition of The Money Show. In addition to our Brutal Biz quiz and the best bits with which you're familiar already, we have the Friday file, the builder of luxury safari lodges in lots of different places. I lost count of the countries where the South African business operates and builds lodges. We're going to talk about a massive fine for Glencore over bribery in multiple African countries. And I wonder whether or not we're surprised. I'm not. I don't know if you are. Shocked, maybe? I'm not sure. Then a look at COP27, the climate change deal that South Africa's hoping to seal in Egypt at COP27 this weekend. The president has been laying out his thoughts and his plans, basically saying that the rich world is not doing enough to support those of us at the southern tip of Africa. He wants to see more grant money coming into the process rather than heavy dollar-based loans. But we'll pick up on that this evening and a whole lot more on The Money Show.
702.
Bruce is on The Money Show.
Siya Biniza is Executive Director at Political Economy Southern Africa. Did you see the President's comments today, Siya? The President coming out boxing ahead of COP27?
Yes, and you know, my biggest concern about this is that they seem to be pushing quite ahead with the just transition, and there are so many pieces that to me still need further clarifying, particularly on the transition part and making sure that no one's left behind. I'm very concerned with even some of the speculation that our government is expected to make an announcement on shutdown of 10 additional power plants, given the fact that we're still a country faced with an energy security crisis on our hands.
Well, again, this is a compromise. The countries that are giving the money and lending the money are countries that are going to want to see some progress being made, I suppose. And, you know, the joy of economics, as you know, is the art of the trade-off. Are you worried that the trade-off is going to be too one-sided and too damaging for South Africa for us to really accept this money with a clear conscience?
Definitely. Look, I must be clear. I'm not one of the climate change denialists, the people who deny, you know, the need to move the transition from fossil fuels. I think it's one of those inevitable parts as we improve our sustainability on the planet. But my concern is that it's always going to be a trade-off between that need for transitioning from fossil fuels with the balancing of the security in terms of energy security needs. So my concern is that, you know, with the movements and the push and the financing that's happening currently, the emphasis is far too strong on our nationally determined contributions and our commitments to the transition on coal, from coal and other fossil fuels. But there seems to be very little emphasis by way of how the broader transition is going to take place. I think most people are looking at this from a narrow window of saying there are people who already got skills and are working in sectors that are linked to fossil fuels, and they see that as one of those necessary, difficult transitions that people need to make, similar to what the approach has been on fourth industrial revolution. But I think the ratification and the dependence sort of extends much greater than just, you know, the coal power plant or people involved in coal industries. I think the implications economy for the country are very understated, and I don't think are very fully understood currently. As a country that still depends quite heavily on exports. And, I mean, we have not even discussed the issue of that with the energy security crisis and the need that demands from us as a country.
See, the line quality, unfortunately, is so deplorable that I need to let you go. I wish I didn't. Siya Biniza, the Executive Director of Political Economy Southern Africa, but he makes the point. And, yes, we can't simply switch off coal tomorrow. It'd be great if we could, but we don't have alternative energy sources in place yet. We also don't have anything for people who are linked to the coal industry to do yet. And so this is why it's called the transition. And this is an incredibly unpopular thing to suggest in a world which is very black and white on the issue of the energy transition. People want all the bad stuff to stop tomorrow, and somehow miraculously, I don't know, how it happens, but there's going to be energy and light and joy and growth and opportunity and optimism and all of those sorts of things. This thing has to be managed very, very carefully. Certainly the president has been speaking this afternoon, and he did a webinar today, and he was saying that the wealthy nations have offered South Africa over until 2050 this $8.5 billion package, and it's a great package. But the problem here is, says Cyril Ramaphosa, there isn't enough in it, which is grant money, so money that doesn't have to be paid back. We need 1.5 trillion rand over the next 5 years. That's just a start to begin this process. Government is trying to secure additional money. It's, you know, we've got massive issues with poverty and unemployment in addition to climate change. And, you know, what the president is saying is that rich countries are not fulfilling the pledges that they made in the Paris talks, so COP26, to help poorer countries cope with climate change. And so he's going to, I think, go in batting quite hard on this particular point, saying, you want us to help you because you're the biggest offenders. I mean, South Africa's a particularly bad offender. But you can't expect us to hold back the little bit of growth that we've got in this economy without some assistance. And that is what he's looking for this weekend. I think it's going to be interesting.
Bruce is on The Money Show.
To Patrick Bond this evening, and it's an astonishing story that doesn't surprise me one little bit, and it's a fact that one of the biggest resources firms listed on the JSE has had to pay an enormous fine in the United Kingdom over bribes across many African countries. Now, Professor Patrick Bond is a political economist. He's Distinguished Professor of Sociology at the University of Johannesburg, and Patrick Bond on The Money Show this evening. 280 million pounds in fines, confiscation orders, and Glencore pleads guilty to 7 counts of bribery related to its oil operations in Africa. Now, we've long suspected that this is the case. This is the first sort of big conviction, Patrick, that I'm aware of a large corporation that's had to admit liability for the way in which it does business on this continent. It's a breakthrough, or not big enough from your perspective.
No, yes, thanks so much for having me, Bruce. What a great show, and I'm so happy to compare notes. I mean, to me, this is trivial, the fine, compared to the profits that they've taken over that particular period in which 5 African countries, Nigeria, Cameroon, Equatorial Guinea, Ivory Coast, and Nigeria, South Sudan, were basically looted by Glencore with the facilitation of bribes. In fact, the you probably have seen the press reports. Private jet airplanes flew in with bags of money. It was brutal and crude. And yet Glencore this year is in such good shape as the world's largest commodity trader, with the commodity prices high, with coal very high, its main asset here in South Africa, iron ore also, the Faroe Alloys. They may get their Cape Town Alstom refinery up and running finally. And they've probably got $20 billion in profits just this year.
I mean, let's put it into real money for a moment here, Patrick, because, I mean, $20 billion sounds like a lot of money, but it's 400 billion rand. I mean, this is, a quarter of South Africa, no, not quite a quarter, maybe a sixth of South Africa's national budget. That's the profit they make. They could run South Africa for 3 months without blinking. They get a fine of $500 million. So, I mean, it's not even a half of 1% of profit that these guys have been fined for wreaking havoc in economies across the continent.
Yes. So Nigeria, Cameroon, Equatorial Guinea, Ivory Coast, South Sudan, those 5 countries, add Venezuela and Brazil, they don't get the money with the exception of Brazil. In June this year, there was a U.S. Fine with the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. That was $1.5 billion. But again, with the Brits, potentially also with Sweden beginning to move into this area. Unfortunately, not the Swiss home base. There's also a Johannesburg Stock Exchange listing, so we really should be moving on this kind of corruption. There's probably with the major activities that have been alleged with Optimum Mine before it was shaken down, with a local Johannesburg CEO for this whole period, Ivan Glasenberg. He's been replaced by another South African, Gary Naylor. We've really got a major stake in this. And I must say that I'm encouraged. This is very unusual because usually I think that the sort of state has been fully captured. And yet in the last month or so, we've seen Bain knocked out of state contracts. We've seen Markus Huster's money and Steinhoff being, sort of finally prosecuted. We finally see Tongaat Hulett unable to sustain itself after that corruption. And is this because, do you think, Bruce, the fear of the grey listing is finally making our officials get a little bit more serious instead of nudge, wink, wink?
I mean, again, I think that's absolutely part of it. I think there's an acceleration and a renewed focus. But at the same time, these things take an infernally long time to build and put together, because on the opposite side of a denuded law enforcement capability in South Africa, you have large corporations with multi-billion rand budgets, and they can throw at anything. And they throw a lot at legal defenses and at legal obfuscation and make life very, very difficult for investigators. But I do like Justice Peter Fraser, who was in the Southwark Crown Court in passing this particular sentence, so it's half a billion rand fine on Glencore, saying bribery was clearly part of the culture for some personnel on the West Africa desk. Now, I wonder if this judgment goes far enough in its condemnation of cultures of crime within some corporations that are much, much higher in others than in others.
Well, this is one absolutely prime case because of its roots in Mark Rich & Company. That was the commodity trading firm that did the South African apartheid era oil embargo sanctions busting.
Now, please, this is deep history here, Patrick. Please go a little bit deeper into this. Remind us who Mark Rich was. Remind us what he did and what his connection, therefore, is to this sort of energy trading that happens on the African continent to this day.
Yes, well, so Rich was from the United States and set up a Swiss company, Mark Rich & Company, and it was eventually, after some turmoil associated with not only apartheid South Africa, but with Iraq under Saddam Hussein, at some point with Iran during the sanctions period. So when Mark Rich was prosecuted and convicted in absentia for tax fraud in the U.S., the way they sometimes, get the criminals there, he had to go into exile. And at some point, because he donated lots of money to the Democratic Party, I was going to say African National Congress, but this is the Democratic Party, he was given a pardon. It was the very last thing that Bill Clinton did in early 2001 before he turned over to George W. Bush. Now, that was very controversial, and it just showed that this, let's say, deep structural corruption in which that kind of bribery could go right to the top of the U.S. government. Now, just think of how easy it was in the West African oil trading, or in a variety of others in which we still don't have enough information. I mean, the allegations that Brian Molefe made, now we don't trust Molefe on principle. He's also under prosecution for his Gupta ties, but he was the CEO of Eskom in an interesting battle, and that was in late 2014. Do you remember there was an Eskom war room? And that war room was headed by the new deputy president, Cyril Ramaphosa. Now, Ramaphosa had been the chair of Optimum and had been a 9% owner at the behest of Glencore, of Ivan Glasenberg. And before Glasenberg was visited by the mining minister, Chwani, by the Guptas, in late 2015 and forced to sort of surrender that mine, a very vast mine that had, unfortunately for Glencore, a very inadequate payment system for the coal in 2014. And that was what they were trying to restructure. And Brian Molefe said, even though he was CEO, he was told by Ramaphosa that he should be paying a much higher price, five times as high, for the coal. And otherwise, the Glencore could export it and get a much higher price. So this was the sort of deal that made Brian Molefe go to the Zondo Commission about a year and a half ago to really say, look for President Ramaphosa's fingerprints on Glencore. Because why not just there, but also in the Longman deal, where Ramaphosa's role in the illicit financial flows to Bermuda was fairly explicit.
Do we ever, Patrick, papers? I mean, do we ever get a finalization of the clear sleaze that exists with political connections, with big business, with favors, with bribes, with all of this stuff? A lot of it is inference. A lot of it is the allegations are made by people who lack credibility. I wonder, there is just so much of this stuff. There is so much of the stuff that goes on. I wonder if we ever get the bottom of it, if we ever get absolute clarity rather than suggestion and inference and an implication rather than real, solid, factual evidence on many of the suppositions that we quite like to accept as gospel.
Oh, I know we desperately need more of you folk who do this kind of digging. Amma Bongani is exceptionally good, or
yep.
Peter Detroit has a new book about the ANC
building. It's good, isn't it?
Let me say, though, the critical question to me is whether the perception of corruption then feeds the corruption. Now, if you take Transparency International, which is the kind of gold standard of the state's corruption, politicians and bureaucrats, well, we've gotten pretty much the same period of 2018 to 2022 that we had the prior 6-7 years under Zuma. And that is ranked number 110th most corrupt out of 180 countries. So let's put it this way. Our politicians and bureaucrats are kind of mediocre. But PwC does a biannual economic crime and fraud survey. All your listeners can find that at pwc.com. The economic crime and fraud. Now, during the 2010s, Bruce, you probably are aware that South African corporates ranked number one in all of those measures of corruption, of economic crime, of bribery, of money laundering, cybercrime, of illicit financial flows and tax dodges. And this year, well, the last time they did it was 2020, the COVID period disrupted it. The South African corporates came in number two, tied with China behind India. Now, that to me is the kind of, okay, now your next question is, can you trust PwC? And of course, if you're, you know, one of the parastatals that hired them, you obviously trust them to cook the books, and they did that a bit, apparently. But I say if they are a corrupt company, then, you know, I trust them more. It takes one to know one. And so they do these biannual. And I think the fact that maybe a few journalists like yourself would be aware, but it's really not talked about the way public sector corruption is, even though there's vast gulf in the world-class economic crime committed in Sandton and Rosebank and Midrand and Stellenbosch and Central Cape Town and Umhlanga, compared to the mediocrity in Pretoria and the, you know, provinces and municipalities. I would put it to you, maybe time to pull that PwC reporting out again and look for exactly what you're asking for.
Dust it off, Patrick. Thank you. Line is breaking up a little bit, but a fascinating discussion this evening with Patrick Bond, political economist. He is a professor of sociology at the University of Johannesburg. And we kind of went off track a little bit, but it's still interesting, just from the level of the environment that has been created in South Africa has enabled so much corruption. And yes, he's absolutely right. It's not just public sector corruption, it's private sector corruption too. But I would love to just get, you know, there's not enough time in our lives to go through absolutely every single case of every single corrupt activity. There just simply isn't the space for it. And it's as a result of the environment we've allowed to ferment in South Africa.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
Now, I don't pretend to understand this. We've had terrible news all week. We've had warnings of recessions and warnings of continuing high interest rates and rising interest rates to try and fight rampant global inflation. And share prices have been under pressure. Until today, we had the most astonishing day. I don't remember when last, if ever, David Peacock, portfolio manager at Sunland Private Investments, who's been in markets for a while, a 5% day, a 3,200-point gain on the all-share index, led higher by resources sectors that are running like a meerkat that has got, I don't know, a pack of dogs on its tail, and it's running for its life. It was the most astonishingly incredible day as far as investor returns were concerned.
Yeah, good evening, Bruce. It's really on the back of this new word that's seems to be creeping into everything now, and the new word is pivot. And the pivot really seems to be coming out of a rumor out of China that they're going to be significantly relaxing the zero COVID policy, and therefore enabling the economy to really get moving again. So clearly, on the back of that, South Africa being the rich resource country that we are, you know, we saw phenomenal moves out of those sectors today. And, you know, some of the shares, Anglo's up like 11% on the day, Kumba Iron Ore running very, very aggressively. So, so positive. However, you know, I just want to, I don't want to burst the bubble, but I just want to say to you that, you know, we had very, very strong turnaround in the markets, but volumes weren't, we didn't have massive volumes. We had sort of an average day of sort of 22, 23 billion rand in terms of turnover. So from that perspective, I would say there's an element of caution in terms of how long this is going to carry on. We had numbers out of the United States in terms of jobs today. And ultimately, those jobs numbers beat expectations. So, for example, non-farm payrolls came in at 261,000 compared to the previous
David, I'm sorry, you sound like you're gargling, and I know you're not, because you are a very kind and generous contributor to The Money Show. But producers, we really need to be better on getting these phone lines right. I know it's not us and it's not our fault and it's cell phone networks and it's load shedding and it's all sorts of other things, but please get David Peacock on a non-gargling line, because I want to hear properly what he says without wanting to switch off and then go throw myself off a bridge. My producers might like that, actually, but I prefer not to do it. I have plans for this evening. I have other plans. And gargly phone lines are deeply offensive to your ears, and I appreciate that. And David Peacock is better than a gargly phone line. We need him to be absolutely clear. And there's this really big gap between all of the negative messaging of the week and then suddenly some slightly better jobs numbers, a rumor that China's going to open up, and suddenly everybody goes completely bananas. And the jobs numbers aren't like exceptional. Maybe even unemployment has picked up a little bit in the United States, David Peacock. So there is a disconnect in the various realities here.
Correct, Bruce. Exactly. So I'm sorry the line's not as clear as it should be.
It's not
so,
you. It's not you, David. It's whoever your cell phone provider is. You can tell me later.
So what I was saying is job numbers came in better than expected, but lower than they were in September. So from that perspective, I would say that would be somewhat positive for the Fed in terms of their attitude towards this pivoting issue, in terms of they did 75 basis points. Everybody anticipated that. And really it's a case of, well, are we getting to the point now where even though the labor market is strong and Powell has stressed this last week that is one of the main focuses of where he's looking, is that the labor market is firm, but it looks like it is easing back a little bit. And frustratingly enough, and that's why I'm just giving a, you know, sounding an air of caution, is that, you know, the U.S. started off up quite strongly, and as the day has sort of progressed, it went into negative territory a while ago and just is sort of at break even at the moment. So, you know, let's be able to enjoy it. Hopefully we will continue to have this strength if we get more information out of China in terms of exactly how they're going to be relaxing the COVID policies and see the stimulus coming into that economy, Bruce.
David, we're going to leave it there. The U.S. markets, the best analogy I can think of, were a bit like your second connection to us this evening. It started crystal clear. It sounded so good and then gradually deteriorated. Back to gargling. But anyway, gargling, no garbage, which is good. David Peacock, portfolio manager at Sunland Private Investments. The phone lines are frustrating as anything, but David Peacock. And yes, there was also an interesting story today, which I would have liked to discuss with David. Canada's Yamana Resources, this is the company that Goldfields is accused of offering too much money for, has got another offer on the table, and it's an offer that looks better than the Goldfields offer. So did Goldfields have a good point? Because now suddenly there's competition. Will Goldfields review its offer, I wonder? We'll have to reflect on that on Monday with hopefully phone lines.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. Celebrate the taste of unrivaled success at the 20th Absa Champagne in Africa Festival. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP.
Well, now you know about it for next year, because they sponsor it every year. This was the 20th anniversary of the Absa Champagne in Africa Festival, and it really was a remarkable event. And Joburg was showing off, and there was a little bit of rain, a bit of thunder, a bit of lightning. It was just a lovely early summer's evening, and everybody went, everyone I saw there seemed to be having an absolutely marvellous, marvellous time. On the next Money Show, Shamil Jessop, the chief executive at Vodacom, looking at results. We've got the radio and TV personality, Rian van Heerden, on Other People's Money. He's also the presenter of CakeNet's Wie Wordt een Miljonair? Who Become a Millionaire? That's what it's called in English. He'll also talk to us about his relationship with money and investing, and Ian Mann with a book, plus all the other big money stories on the day, next time on The Money Show.
The Money Show.
The Friday File.
The Friday File.
So we're going to ask you to live vicariously. And if you've been to one of the beautiful lodges that we're about to mention and you want to show off about it, are you welcome to show off about it? Because we're talking to Luxury Frontiers this evening on our Friday File. Luxury Frontiers is a company that builds the lodges. They have built the most astonishing properties in multiple parts of the world, lots in Botswana. And I was just looking at the portfolio this afternoon of the properties they've built, and Botswana and the United States and Zambia and there's one in South Africa. That's good. There are just loads of the most glorious properties. And Graham Labe is the managing director, the principal at Luxury Frontiers. How did Luxury Frontiers get into this line of work, Graham?
Good evening, Bruce, and good evening to your listeners. So how we got into this is between myself and my business partner, Luca Franco, who's based in San Francisco. I had originally worked with a safari company called Abercrombie & Kent as their design director. And we really saw a gap in the market on an international basis to take the concept of ecotourism and light on earth tourism into the Americas, Europe. And we really, you know, kind of saw the opportunity of wildlife areas outside of Africa.
But you've also continued in Africa. I mean, Botswana and Zambia and South Africa. You've got tented camps which you've created, but you've also gone. I mean, I'm sure your portfolio is much bigger than you put on your website. But there's a glorious camp in Costa Rica, and another glorious camp in the United States. Stretch tents, lots of canvas and leather and poles and timber, natural products and natural elements being brought into the most beautiful wilderness areas. How do you find your customers? Because do they find you?
They tend to find us in turn through, we've been very fortunate through word of mouth. And I think one of our key factors in part of our success is we have been fortunate enough to work with some of the top brands around the world, both safari brands and hotel brands. They are ranging from the wilderness safaris in Africa through to Aman Resorts, through to Four Seasons, Hyatt, Marriott, Belmont. So it really kind of started through word of mouth. And it's just begun to roll out just through the fortunate circumstances of working with these brands.
Do you operate out of South Africa and San Francisco? I mean, Stefan Anthony famously operates out of Cape Town and serves clients all over the globe. Do you use a South African-based, South African teams, rand cost-based to deliver dollar-denominated projects everywhere?
Absolutely. I think that's been part of our success in the international market, is that we have been able to deliver an exceptionally high level of design and curation by using a South African team with very talented young architects, interior designers. And literally, we've been able to do it. It was probably at half the cost that our competition in Europe or the US have been able to do it.
And that's the wonderful thing about it, isn't it? I mean, it's you've got a great design ethos. The sort of barefoot luxury that you're representing here, I mean, these are very smart lodges, but they're incredibly relaxed and casual spaces too, so that people, when they go on holiday, don't feel uptight and not wearing a tux to dinner every night. It's not that kind of place. But yet, it encapsulates the joy of outdoor living and being out in nature. The sort of that marriage of nature and structure is very much there.
Well, that's really part of the ethos of our company. Is we see ourselves as, you know, in terms of our kind of primary design drivers through biophilic design, and you know, taking that as an ethos really runs through all through our design. And it has opened up huge markets for us. And what we found is that the growth, and I mean, this sounds really strange, is since COVID, we've seen such a growth in the market and a want in the market. And we really believe that COVID, you know, was a catalyst for a lot of mind shift on how people experience their holidays and experience their own personal time.
I think, I mean, people with the resources certainly are willing, I suspect, and just from conversations I've had with people with those kinds of resources, they're willing to throw more of those resources at experiences, and they want those experiences when they have them to be memorable, because suddenly you realize that when you're locked up at home for 2 years, you're not generating too many memories, and the photographs all look the same. They're all in the same space. So you do want new photographs to add to the family album. How do you deliver the projects? You can sit here and you can design the projects in South Africa. Do you send plans to other people to execute, or do you send teams into the sites themselves to actually deliver on the project so that you get precisely the spec and the detail that you want to have it absolutely 100%?
It's a combination of both. As I said, we do also have a presence in San Francisco. We have a small mm-hmm. delivery team in San Francisco, and we're in fact about to open up an office in Miami as well to assist us with delivery. But what we tend to do is we tend to work with what we call an architect of record. So in terms of permitting and to cut through all the legal issues, we go into a joint venture with a local architect who handles the stages of work, which we call the construction. It's what we would normally term as our stage five works of construction drawings or working drawings. And then together with the architect of record, they help us through the monitoring of the program of construction. But we are very much part of that program. We do it through constant visualization of the project through drone footage. There is a very, very clever camera system called a Matterport that we use quite extensively. And what it does, it takes a 3D photograph of the various buildings that we have designed. They send us these images, and the images allow us to walk through the buildings and literally be able to measure and check every part of the building through distance. And it's amazing what technology has become, but we cannot beat on-site inspection and work. So our teams also travel extensively.
And you've never been busier, Graham. I mean, that's certainly the sense I get from you.
It's quite amazing. As we've seen, most probably from the start of 2022, a huge uptake, and our projections are phenomenal for 2023.
That's fantastic. It really is, Graham. Thank you for chatting to us this evening. Graham Laib, Managing Director and Principal at Luxury Frontiers. They design what they call sustainable and immersive resorts and lodges. And if you want to see how the other 0.5% lives, the other, I want to see how the 0.1% lives and goes on holiday, just treat yourself to the spectacle and the wonder and the brilliance of South African design, innovation at home on projects delivered anywhere. It's magnificent. It's called luxuryfrontiers.com.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
We have rules on this show. We do things in a certain way, and it's worked that way for very well for a long time. Just before we go into the Brutal Biz Quiz on a Friday night, I finish an interview and I ask a question. And George forgot, I forgot, and so we've let you down, for which we apologize. I would like you to give us a call right now, please, to play the Brutal Biz Quiz on this Friday evening. I'd like you to name the Mpumalanga Power Station, which is the first of probably many that are going to have to be decommissioned in the next couple of years. It is a coal-fired power station in Mpumalanga. It's reached the end of its operating life, and it was decommissioned on Monday. And it's been operating since 1961. It had its final generating unit taken offline on Monday. And that unit, which was commissioned in March 1966, was the last of nine units that were built. Other units were shut down over the years as they reached the end of their operating life. But what is the name of this this power station? This power station is going to be repurposed, and it's going to be part of the first bit of the Just Energy Transition project that's going to be funded by a World Bank loan of about 8 billion rand. So what is the name of the power station? Bongiwe in, I'm sure it's Kyalami, not Kyakami, but hey, we'll be calm.
Yes, it is, Bruce, and it's Komatipoort.
It is Komati. Well, it's not Komatipoort, actually, but we'll give it to you. Komati Power Station. Komatipoort is further down the road. But yes, Komati Power Station. George, applause? No applause? Is she not worth it? I think Boogie was worth it. A round of applause. There we go. Thank you. Thank you, team. The Fed, the US Fed, has raised interest rates several times this year. How many times has it raised interest rates? Has it raised interest rates five times? Has it raised interest rates six times, or has it raised interest rates eight times so far this year?
Six times.
Oh, that was an apprehensive and a tentative six, but it was a good six, Bongiwe. It was a good six, absolutely right. 75 basis points for the fourth time in a row. Money is becoming increasingly expensive and therefore scarce. And that hopefully will start taming global inflation. There is a company listed on the JSE that has been ordered to pay billions of rand for bribing African officials. What is the name of the listed company on the JSE that we spoke about with Patrick Bond half an hour ago?
Oh, shucks. Oh, my God. I couldn't hear properly. Okay. No.
You need to get to the. You need to get to the core of the answer on this one, Bongiwe. Where just get straight to the core.
Driving. God, I was half listening and half not driving.
Oh, you were concentrating on the road. What a good person you are. But being a good person doesn't win you the biz quiz, I'm afraid, Bongiwe, but you're wonderful. Thank you for playing our Brutal Biz Quiz this Friday night. Got us off to a nice start. Which company has had to pay a massive fine for bribing firms in Nigeria, Cameroon, Ivory Coast, all over the place, and the Southwark Crown Court? I do like the way the Brits are prosecuting these crimes. Henry in Boksburg. Who are the bad guys?
Hi, Bruce. It's Glencore.
Absolutely right. Glencore. I would like to know the name of the new president of Brazil, the man acquitted in a bribery scandal that was dubbed Operation Car Wash.
I forgot his name. I listened to the show the other night, but I can't remember his name.
It's one name, Henry, that you're never going to forget, because we'll give it to you in just a moment. Motlo Diwa, what is the name of the new president of Brazil?
What's the next question?
What is the name of the new president of Brazil, Motlo Diwa? There's a family argument in the background. I love this. Keep fighting. It's most entertaining. It's better than reality TV. It's like watching the Kardashians if they've had too much to drink. I don't know. What's the answer? I don't know the question. What? I love that. Thank you so much for amusing me. Andre Primrose, help put us out of our misery.
Hi, Bruce. Is it Lula?
What is his full name?
Bruce, I genuinely don't know.
No, but nobody does, because it's quite complicated, and I'm going to mispronounce it, and I apologize to anybody who speaks Portuguese. But Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. But so they call him Lula, and it's Lula he's Silva, like yeah. Lula da Silva. He's made the massive comeback. He's not quite as old as Joe Biden, but at 77, he's whipped Jair Bolsonaro, not a nice man as Bolsonaro, who's admitted defeat this week, actually, and has agreed to go peacefully, which is a relief, I think, all round. Andre, well done to you in Primrose. We'll make you the whiz of the Brutal Biz Quiz on this Friday evening. The Money Show, of course, is brought to you by Absa CIB, host of world-class events such as the Absa Champagne in Africa Festival. That's Africa Nacity. Absa is a registered FSP. And on this Friday night, Andre, with the Lula question, the Lula answer, actually, is the whiz of the Brutal Biz Quiz this Friday night.